a Swiss-German eccentric who lived in Soho, made an offer. He'd either pay for her college education, or he'd get her a sailboat. But if she took the sailboat, she had to sail around the world. By herself. And she had no sailing and navigation experience. And he wasn't going to flat out buy the boat for her either. He'd just give her a loan so she could do all of this, even though she'd expressed, like, zero interest in sailing, like, ever. So what did she do? She fucking sailed around the world by herself, even though she had no idea how to sail or navigate. First American woman and the youngest person up to that point ever to do it. Took her 2 years. So maybe there was a method to our parents' madness. By the way, I was always a little scared of her dad, though. Yauk and I would sit around and listen to records endlessly and laugh about shit. He was quiet, but with an unflappable intensity and focused enthusiasm, whether for a record or an activity. He'd keep pushing you to listen, keep going until shit was accomplished. He just had a greater degree of determination and decisiveness than the rest of us. He was also funny. It'll probably make no sense to you, but my favorite mannerism of his was this thing that he and his friend David Wade would do. Back then, after somebody would do something ridiculous or was the subject of an insult, most kids would say, "Burn!" But Yauk and Wade had their own version of this, where they'd do this weird hand motion and say, "Woof!"
You'd make the okay hand sign, put the circle that your pointer finger and thumb would make next to your eye, then bring that circle right down to the person who had fallen down, dropped their food, or got snapped on, then say, "Boof!" in a weird low tone.
It was nonsensical and totally fucking hilarious. If we'd grown up almost anywhere else in the world, our crew wouldn't have had such a steady flow of amazing events that we could all go to, unaccompanied by parents. First of all, in other cities, you'd have to drive to shows, which automatically meant a parent. Second, because all of our parents were artists or intellectuals, they gave us an unusual amount of freedom. It was still kind of the 70s in terms of parenting. My mom had certain time structures. Like, you know, I couldn't be out late on a school night, and I had to be clear about where I was and where I was going. But her basic attitude was, if your schoolwork doesn't suffer, you can do whatever you want. If it does, Michael, we have a problem. One time, I stayed out all night without calling my mom, and she understandably lost her mind when I got home. She got super fucking pissed and grounded me. So I learned the hard way. There were limits.
Yes, even Mike D gets grounded. Boof.
Everybody in our crew had parents that were, in one way or the other, similarly lenient. So even though we were barely just teenagers, we got this powerful shared experience of going to punk shows, running around deserted downtown Manhattan, and becoming close friends in the process. It sounds kind of corny, but it was magical. And after a while, something began to dawn on us as our lives became increasingly organized around bands and shows. We should try doing this ourselves.
Well, back in my day, by Adam Horovitz, wearing a backpack was not cool. I mean, unless there's textbooks in there and you're actually going to or coming from school. Otherwise, do not wear one. And on your way to and from school, having on both backpack straps was square. It could only hang from one strap on one shoulder. And you'd have to have buttons on your backpack. Band buttons. Not too many, just a few. 5 was the limit for sure. You couldn't appear as though you were trying too hard. The minutia of dumb details in a 15-year-old's mind are fantastic. So, being that I often cut school, I had to just carry around a bunch of shit in my pockets. You know, with the no backpack rule and everything. And by shit, I mean my tapes and my Walkman. There was a different connection to your music back then, the cassette tape era. You had to plan your day around your cassettes. How many could you fit in your pockets? Obviously, winter was an easier time because you had way more storage options. Jackets, coats, down vests, etc. More pockets. You had to think this shit through. What did you want to listen to that day? Who are you going to run into? Because you didn't want to get busted with only the Psychedelic Furs Talk 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 tape on you, even though you loved that shit. You had to have the cool shit on you, just in case. You might end up at someone's apartment and want to put some music on. You had to have variety. Oh, and also, remember, this is the 80s, so there's no baggy anything. It's just tight pants with bulging rectangular pockets. No, that's not a knot of cash in my pocket. It's the Minor Threat A-side, Black Flag B-side tape, and the Slits A-side, Marvin Gaye's Greatest Hits B-side, and so on. Having 8 cassette tapes shoved into your front and back pockets walking around all day is a schleppy look. I would have fucking loved the shit out of having an iPhone. For real. Anyone who's trying to convince you that tapes are cool and that iPhones are corny is dead wrong. I can tell you from experience and with a professional's opinion, the cassette versus vinyl versus CD versus MP3 argument is boring. If I made you a mixtape and you've just heard the JB song Pass the Peas for the first time, the song would be just as fucking awesome if I emailed you an MP3 instead. I promise. Being able to scroll and click to get to the next song is a wonderful new feature. Yeah, but MP3 sound terrible. Who cares? Try scotch taping a broken cassette tape 4 or 5 times in different places on the tape and then listen back to that after it's been in various linty pockets for 1.5 years. To me, the only thing that's really missing with the iPhone is that physical relationship to your music. If I added it up, I feel like I've wasted 261 solid hours of my life just watching cassette tapes rewind and fast-forwarding. There was no drag and drop onto a playlist to make a mixtape. To record X-Ray Spex's song Identity onto a tape, you had to listen to the whole song as you recorded it. So a whole album took a while. Jimmy Spicer's song Adventures of Super Rhyme is like 15 minutes long. Just that one song. Maybe that's why my attention was so limited when it came to doing homework. If I had fucking iTunes, I would have had time to read the book for school instead of glancing at the cliff notes. Or asking my best friend Arthur Africano to describe what happened in that book because he would actually read the books for homework. You couldn't just Google search for a podcast to listen to. No Spotifying anything. You had to wait until the radio show you wanted to tape came on. Tim Summers, Noise the Show, The Red Alert Show, Mr. Magic Show, and Gil and Pat Bailey Show, etc. And then actually sit there for the whole hour that it took to tape it. Live streaming meant just that. If your stereo couldn't record what the radio was playing, you'd have to put a tape recorder right up next to the speaker so you could tape that radio show you wanted. The physical thing of taking the record out, queuing up the song you want to record on the turntable, letting it play, pushing the play and record buttons on the cassette recorder at the perfect time, you didn't want a lot of dead airspace on your tape, then repeating that for 45, 60, or 90 minutes was an all-day, all-night event. It might have been the most physical labor I've done in my life. And if the tape you're making was meant to be a gift for someone, it took serious focus. It was rarely just about sharing songs via a cassette. It was way bigger than that. Artistic decisions, emotional decisions, and depending on who you were making it for, strategic decisions went into its making. For certain people, you gotta remind them that you have a way better record collection than they do. And this tape I'm giving you now will show and prove it. Not that it's a competition, but it always is. You could keep it brief with a 30-minute tape, but maybe that's too brief. The 90-minute tape is a bit much. It can get tiresome, unless that tape was meant for background music. The 120-minute tape is for obsessive compulsives with too much time on their hands. In my opinion, the 60-minute tape is the best of the cassette tape lengths. You're putting work in, but not going overboard. If you have romantic intentions, don't get creepy. For sure go with the 60. After you finish making your tape, you'd have to make a cover for it. You couldn't just have the white TDK sleeve with the song titles. You'd want your tape to have cool covers like your LPs, flyers, and fanzines. The outside cover would be some kind of picture you cut out of a magazine or your science book or whatever. You'd scotch tape it to the blank cover that came with a cassette so you could write down the songs on the tape on the back. And then you'd doctor up the actual tape itself. You'd draw a few different colors for outlines around the band's name or the title you'd given the mixtape. Paint pens were a game changer when they came out. It was a process. But, you know, you can fit more tapes in your pockets without the cases, so the tapes themselves gotta look fresh. Oh, also, very important, the tabs. Every blank cassette has these 2 little rectangular plastic tabs on top. You can record on a tape only if the tabs are still there. If the tabs have been taken off, like every store-bought album on cassette, you'd have to put scotch tape or a sticker over where the tab was. The top left corner. That's the record tab on the side of the tape you're recording. So, when you're done, don't forget to pop the tabs or peel the tape off the pop tabs, or else you're going to record over what's on the tape on accident. Like how I have a tape of the Jam's sound effects that I recorded me and Yauk having a super boring conversation over. Funny now, but aggravating then. If you were listening to this when you were in high school in 1981, you would really thank me for saving you the time of figuring all this out for yourself. Not only was it not cool to wear a backpack, it was really uncool to be like, hey, can you show me how to do this thing that I don't know how to do? Also, who would you ask? An older kid? No way. Pre-YouTube, you were on your own. Cassette tape upkeep is fucking delicate. After carrying the same tapes in your tight, linty pocket for months and playing them 1,001 times, the tape would inevitably get wound up and stuck in the tape heads. Everything would stop. Through the little windows on the cassette, you could see the gears of the tape moving around like a dryer at the laundromat. Suddenly, you would see the tape you'd spent hours making all bunched up. That moment felt like when a computer freezes and a sad face image shows up on the screen. You'd have to stop whatever you were doing and deal with this dire situation immediately. The tape would be all squished up into the machine and mangled. Taking it out was like pulling 60 minutes of wet fettuccine out of a dog's mouth. It was as though the tape and tape deck were mad at you for being a careless and impatient teenager. Damn kids, always rewinding and fast-forwarding. Just let the songs play all the way through or it's gonna break. To fix that tape, you'd have to gently and painstakingly pull the tape out of the deck, knowing when to force it and when to go real slow. And finally, when you get the tape out, you'd get a tiny Phillips head screwdriver and unscrew the screws holding the tape's housing together. You'd open it up, cut the tape at its most damaged point, unravel the tape, put a tiny piece of scotch tape on a table, match both ends of broken tape, join the two ends with that tiny piece of scotch tape, screw the housing back together, and then the pencil. You'd have to wind the cassette tape back into its housing so it'd be ready to play again. The pencil was the perfect tool to fit inside the cassette's little plastic gears, so you'd sit there and wind and wind and wind and wind. It seems like it's just so easy to know things now. To know about movies or art or music or food preparations or the 1950s roller derby circuit. But in 1978, junior high school, besides what was on the 7 available TV channels or WPLJ radio, we didn't know anything important about life, like sex, and what you're supposed to do and how to have it, or anything else, really, that we actually wanted to know. The library on 10th Street didn't have what I was looking for at age 15. In 2000 whatever, if you want to learn how to play a song on the guitar, someone's on YouTube waiting to teach you how to play that exact song, or build that record shelf, or how to have sex and what it looks like. Does all this accessible information give you confidence as a junior high schooler, or is it too overwhelming? Like, you're supposed to know how to do this already, dumbass. Your record collection is supposed to be all-encompassing of your 15-year-old world. You don't have to figure out where did this come from, or how do you do this. Google will tell you that insert whatever current band that a current 15-year-old would listen to, was totally inspired by the Strokes, who were inspired by television, who were inspired by... and so on. So you can have Brenda Lee on your iPhone because in a random search, that band that you love was inspired by so-and-so, and they did this and that, and that someone loved Brenda Lee. Within minutes, you would have all of that backstoried information. And within minutes, you're now listening to Brenda Lee's voice for the first time, and you're like, oh shit. With the iPhone, you no longer have to worry that some square would think you were square for carrying around that psychedelic Furs Talk 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 tape in your pocket because it'd be buried deep amongst 12 billion MP3s. I'm not trying to be all, well, back in my day, we had to carry blocks of ice up a mountain made of shards of broken glass just to drink a hatful of rain. But it's true that the physical relationship to music was different. There was more touching, holding, caressing, and finessing. Making, listening to, and caring for cassettes is the most hands-on and personal music listening experience, for sure. You don't just listen, you're very involved. I do miss that, but I don't miss schlepping all of those fucking tapes around in my tight, bulky pockets like a scrub. And like so many really close friendships, sadly, me and my tapes have drifted apart. All that said, the experience of a 15-year-old kid obsessing over music is basically the same as it's been since the fucking gramophone or player piano. Endless hours sitting in bedrooms or on stoops or whatever the suburban equivalent is to a stoop, waiting for a friend to show up, waiting for something to happen, waiting to have sex, waiting to understand your weird parents, waiting to understand anything in the world, waiting to go somewhere else. It all needs a soundtrack, your soundtrack. Since forever in time, we've all had our, I just got dumped, I'm gonna break up with you, I'll love you forever, no one gets it, and entrance to the party songs. It's just easier to physically carry them with you now.
Black Flag at the Peppermint Lounge by Michael Diamond. Back in 81, the area near Times Square was straight up suspect. The Lower East Side, where we often hung out, may have been more dangerous, but Times Square was somehow much scarier. On the Lower East Side, the drug dealers were busy with a steady stream of dedicated customers. They were not hustling us, whereas in Times Square, it was always on full display. A carnival of live sex shows, porn theaters, and third-run kung fu movies attended by feral masturbators. Not a hood that we would visit for pretty much any reason. Until sometime in January or February 1981, when it was announced that the Peppermint Lounge, a club on West 45th Street that was renowned for being an incubator for the dance craze, The Twist, in the early 1960s, would be hosting the first ever East Coast performance by Black Flag. I fucking love Black Flag. Before I got their first EP, Nervous Breakdown, I had listened to many hours of punk rock, but this was something radically different. Noisier, super aggressive, and dissonant, with lyrics filled with paranoia and anger. Some of the ingredients had existed before, in bands like the Stooges, the Ramones, Black Sabbath, and the Dead Boys. But no one had put it together into anything like this. I mean, at the time, I had absolutely no frame of reference for Greg Ginn's incredible guitar playing. It was like some terrifying alien assault of squeal. When I listen now, it has more in common with the free jazz of Archie Shepp to me than the crunch of Sex Pistols' Steve Jones. As a 13-year-old, I couldn't really compute, but I fucking loved it. Nervous Breakdown was a bird call to so many of us who were too young for the first wave of punk rock and craved an outburst of pure noise that we could call our own. So as soon as the announcement went out, life became, Black Flag is coming! Black Flag is coming! Our crew was completely amped. We got our hardcore uniforms on, our boots, our cuffed-up jeans, our white t-shirts, and headed to the club, ready for, well, I guess we had no idea what we were really ready for. I guess that's the point. But whatever we were expecting, it was nothing like what we found. First of all, the Peppermint Lounge was not small. The stage alone was bigger than most of the clubs we went to. This was not home court, like walking into CBGB or A7. The punk scene we were part of was essentially a small handful of art kids, and there were a few of them at the Black Flag show, including, I'd find out later, Adam Horovitz, whom we hadn't met yet. Mostly, though, the Peppermint Lounge was filled with gladiators we'd never seen before. Tons of suburban kids, mostly dudes, from Long Island and New Jersey and Queens, attracted not only by the music, but its rage. With 200-ish angry youths in the room, some may be fucked up and ready to go off, the show was like a powder keg waiting for a match, a gathering of outcasts who'd been waiting their whole lives for this moment.
I was there with Nick Cooper. The place was super-duper packed. It felt very football team dude-ish. And I 100% remember seeing all you guys in the back of the place doing silly dances, making fun of people, and cracking up. You looked like the fun kids to hang out with. I remember because I saw Jill and Kate, who I recognized from around the neighborhood. It might quite possibly be the night that Michael Lewis Diamond, Adam Nathaniel Yauch, and I were first introduced.
When the band eventually took the stage, the match was lit. It was as loud, abrasive, and straight-up exciting as a show could be. Shit was jumping off. I remember Greg Ginn's clear Lucite guitar with the band's Four Bars logo painted on it. I remember how Robo's cymbals were flat and not tilted. I remember how bass player Chuck Dukowski was missing a tuning peg, so he used pliers to put his bass in tune.
Black Flag weren't dressed like punks. That was cool to me. I couldn't afford Doc Martens and a whole punk kit, so my beat-up sneaks and lame button-down shirts were fine. They kind of looked like the weird kids who hung out in that weird room in my high school, the one with that weird thing called a computer. It was as if those kids from the computer room were playing Ramones songs, really fast and really loud.
Mostly, I remembered that it was the first time I'd seen kids really slam dancing and moshing. It was amazing, and it was terrifying. It turned out the dudes who actually knew how to mosh that night were a dedicated hardcore crew from Washington, D.C., who drove up in two vans to see the show, even though Black Flag was playing D.C. three nights later. Among them were Minor Threat singer Ian MacKaye, his younger brother and member of the Faith, Alec MacKaye, Henry Garfield, singer in State of Alert, and a bunch of other DC and Discord Records associates. I'd later become friends with most of them, but their attitude that night was, "Fuck New York and everyone in it. We hate you." From a 1981 review that was printed in a zine called Critical List. DC people were the rowdiest dancers, occasionally clamoring on a stage over 5 feet high and falling back into the crowd. Dez thanked DC punks for coming to the show. Most of the New York crowd, minus a select few, were pretty lame. By the end of the show, everyone there knew people were up there from DC, and most felt intimidated. The show was probably one of the greatest we've ever seen, and it will be a long time before we forget it. They were really intimidating, they knew it, and all of that came out in the first hardcore pit I'd ever witnessed. Our crew was literally pushed against the back wall like scared kids at a high school prom, by the chaos and energy of the music and the pit in a way that we had never seen before. Not that I ever went to a high school prom, or maybe this show was kind of like my prom. By the end of the show, both the band and its audience were soaked through with sweat, shirts dripping, gasping for air, wondering what the fuck just happened. It was perfect. I guess every generation of music fans in every city has a moment that, in hindsight, stops time and focuses the energy of everyone in attendance. For us, it was Black Flag at the Peppermint Lounge. In retrospect, maybe the most impressive thing about the show is how many bands formed at that moment and in the aftermath. It inspired Yauch and John and me to form Beastie Boys a few months later. It inspired Adam Horovitz to form The Young and the Useless. Thurston Moore was there. He was already playing around with Kim, but they didn't debut as Sonic Youth until later that year. And that summer, DC punk and mosher Henry Garfield, who was seeing Black Flag for the first time that night, would join the group as its singer under the name Henry Rollins. To him, and all of us in the audience, that night in March changed what we thought was possible.
Boys and a Girl, Entering Anarchistic States Toward Inner Excellence, by Michael Diamond, read by Kim Gordon. My first band was actually called Young Aborigines. It had formed before the Black Flag show as early as 1979 or 1980. Lineup: me on drums, John Barry on guitar, Jeremy Satin on bass, and Kate Schellenbach on percussion. We met Kate at some point in the context of going to shows: Stimulators, Irving Plaza, Tier 3. She was easily the smartest member of the Young Aborigines. She went to Stuyvesant High School, a big competitive magnet school for math and science nerds. She lived in a loft on West 14th Street, back when lofts were actually raw and cold, and when there was no glamour whatsoever to be found on 14th Street. Mostly what you'd find were stores lining up to sell velvet Elvises and other textile art masterworks. We never got around to getting a full-time singer. We tried a couple, but nothing ever worked, and it was a job that none of us wanted. We just wanted to be in a band and make music. We were not yet completely consumed with hardcore 7-inches and going to hardcore shows. Young Aborigines was inspired by the Slits, the Young Marble Giants, Gang of Four, Public Image Limited, all this post-punk stuff that we loved. But with no singer and no experience, we couldn't do much except practice, which we did as often as we could for months and months. Our practice space was on the third floor at John Barry's house on the northwest corner of 100th and Broadway. How do I even begin to describe this place? Start with the fact that it was an old, squat, three-story wooden structure in the middle of a concrete jungle. Like someone had forgotten to tear the place down when they were building the rest of the modern city. Also, for a wood building, it was ancient, literally 100 years old. It had been a saloon in the late 1800s, before the streets up here were even fucking paved. And the place looked and felt like it hadn't been touched since. It was a dilapidated, sagging, slant-roofed structure of rotting wood, parked in a sea of concrete, brick, and steel. At that point, there was a greasy Cuban Chinese restaurant on the ground floor. That's right, Cuban Chinese. John and his dad lived above the restaurant. John's bedroom, where we practiced, was the building's third-floor loft. The second floor was a single open room, but not like a glamorous designer loft. Large windows were set in rotting and splintered wooden frames. Fading and chipped paint covered the clapboard. Every piece of furniture looked like it had been found on the street. There was even a hammock hanging over one of the windows. If ever there was a person destined to live in this building, it was John Barry's dad. He was a man from another era. He worked as editor-in-chief of Library Journal, and he was a 1930s-style left-leaning intellectual with a serious work ethic and clothes to match. Worn blue jeans, button-down Oxford shirt and tie, always a Harris tweed blazer, complete with elbow patches. Framed pictures of Che Guevara, books on Lenin and Trotsky, and pamphlets about the IRA lay around the house. He was radical without the chic, like something out of a Studs Terkel book. And he was as pragmatic and grouchy as any other hard-working single dad during, say, the Depression might have been. Every night he would get home from work and want his glass of scotch. He'd often follow up with half a pin joint. I'm not talking kush or indo. This was 100% leafy shake that legit smelled like burning leaves. Then he'd prop his feet up literally and start reading. In this big room filled with the books and ephemera of a socialist intellectual librarian. And we knew better than to disturb this important state of unwind. He gave John and all of us a long leash, but when he got home, band practice was over. Upper Broadway at that time was like a multicultural mixtape. Salsa blaring on one block, a JVC boombox playing rap outside a housing project on the next. Sounds of AM broadcasts from Panasonic clock radios coming out of open windows on the next. Across 100th Street from John's place was this large residential hotel, politely known as an SRO, single-room occupancy building, and impolitely known as a flophouse. Shit would really go down there. It seemed like every afternoon or evening, cops would appear for some kind of drug raid or prostitution shakedown. Or domestic disturbance, or who the fuck knew what. One day, John and I sat on his roof and witnessed someone in the heat of an argument throw a small sink out of a very high window. We watched as it plummeted and crashed on the 100th Street sidewalk. The constant hubbub across the street worked out well for us, though, because it allowed us to play music as loud as we wanted. Who was going to make a noise complaint when people across the street were using sinks to play Death Charge? We were pretty far down the precinct to-do list, so we just set up and practiced after school on the third floor where John lived. When we weren't actually practicing, our whole cast of characters just hung out and played music full blast. Yauch didn't play in Young Aborigines, but he was around so much that he was our unofficial fifth member and one-man tech crew. We called Yauch the techno whiz for a reason. He somehow knew how to do all this handy technical shit. Everything from wiring a 70s flash bulb so it could be detonated as an explosive to fixing a microphone cable with a soldering gun. As for instruments and amps, he actually had an understanding of how that stuff worked, how it should be set up and treated, which the rest of us did not. At some point after the Black Flag show at the Peppermint Lounge, he started egging us on to form a side band, one that dispensed with arch post-punk artiness and instead played straight hardcore. The new style forged by our bad brains that we love so much. We even had a name ready to go. Beastie Boys. Actually, we were a button before we were a band. All of us were obsessed with the slightly older punk rocker, Nick Martin, the cool kid at the Bad Brains show the night I met Yauch. Nick did a great job of making his own buttons. Or to use the punk rock term, badges. One afternoon while fooling around on our instruments and talking about a band name, we all came up with Beastie Boys. Beastie was an acronym for Boys Entering Anarchistic States Toward Internal Excellence. Don't ask, no idea. Well, the acronym alone made no sense. It made even less sense when combined with boys, since the acronym already contained that word. Now the name was ridiculous and redundant, and also incorrect, since we had a girl drummer. Anyway, it stuck. The next time I saw Yauch, he'd already made our first ever badge before we'd even practiced a single time. Meanwhile, Young Aborigines, like any typical high school band, had an epic months-long run of practices, played two shows in one night, then promptly broke up. The two shows were on Friday, June 19th, 1981. One was at 171A, a punk rock recording studio. The other was at a club downtown somewhere, opening for an LA punk band called UXA.
The bass player in UXA was a guy from Brooklyn named David Danford, aka Bosco. He's best known to the general public as the bassist in the Darby Crash Band, to whom Darby, the infamous singer of the Germs, addressed his suicide note. My life, my leather, my love go to Bosco. I later became friends with Bosco, rest in peace, and played with him in the bands Big Fat Love and Flophouse Society Orchestra.
There were at most five people at each show, including Yauch, our one-man road crew. I can't remember exactly why we broke up after those shows, and it may not have been as well articulated as all that. We all wanted to be in a band, yet none of us in Young Aborigines were driven enough to take it anywhere. But Adam Yauch was. The simplest way to put it is that Beastie Boys took over and Young Aborigines faded away. Beastie Boys had actually started to practice once in a while, and the pace increased after the Aborigines split up. I'd been nominated singer. Since this was hardcore, actual singing ability wasn't so important. Kate switched from percussion to drums. John still played guitar. Jeremy wasn't as psyched on hardcore as I think we were, so Yauch called it, kind of like shotgun, bass. Even though Yauch was a year older than us, he was still like a puppy, with hands and feet that were way oversized for his body.
Years later, I still vividly remember bassist Daryl Jennifer from Bad Brains grabbing Yauch's hands and going, "These are bass player's hands. Look at these long fingers."
He also had the look-down, rolled-up straight-leg blue jeans, green army jacket, ox-blood Doc Martens, hair cut short. Writing hardcore songs is not that complicated, right? Do this part 8 times, do that part 4 times, repeat it once, the end. Pretty quickly, we had about 20 minutes of original music. Most of our practices were at the 100th Street Shanty. Sometimes we'd have them in Yauch's bedroom at his parents' home in Brooklyn Heights. Unlike Barry's place, Yauch's was clean and well-designed. His father, Noel, was an architect and an amazing cook, so I'd always happily stay for dinner after messing around with music. Looking back, I still can't believe that Noel and his wife, Frances, were tolerant enough to let us make the racket we did up in that bedroom. God bless them.
In 1987, after License to Ill became a huge hit, Noel Yauch described those early days to the LA Times. The funny thing is, when I was Adam's age, I came to New York to be an abstract painter, and my parents thought I was nuts. I look at Adam now, and the whole thing seems to be history repeating itself. The words that want to come out of my mouth are the words my father was saying to me, and I'm trying not to say them. My mom, on the other hand, had this to say in the article. I was at this party the other night, and this man went on and on about how the Beatles had ruined Western civilization for the last 20 years. I listened for a while and finally said, "If you had problems with them, you ought to hear my son's band."
We were coming up on Yauch's birthday, August 5th, 1981. He was turning 17. We still hadn't played a gig as Beastie Boys. One day after practice, he motivated us all by saying, "Hey, let's have my birthday party at John's Loft and play at it." Seemed like a good enough idea at the time. Our equipment was already there for starters. So the word went out, Yauch's birthday party, 100th Street Loft. Maybe 2 dozen people showed up. us, the bag ladies, a few of Yak's oldest friends, and Dave Parsons and his girlfriend Kathy from a newly opened and really cool downtown record store called Rat Cage. We sat around listening to records, just hanging out, talking, drinking beer, smoking cigarettes. Eventually, we moved John's bed against the wall so that we had a dance floor of sorts and got up the courage to put on our instruments and play. And yeah, it did take courage, especially being a singer for the first time. It was embarrassing to put yourself out there, being an awkward teenager without any real experience, performing a few feet away from the friends you see on the regular and whose taste you respect and trust.
For several of the girls in attendance, hardcore was all male aggression and formulaic songs. So not everyone we went to shows with was on board with our new hardcore direction.
I was usually pretty shy and quiet, so to be yelling lyrics into a mic felt deeply foreign. I remember looking down at the floor a bunch because I wanted to make as little eye contact as possible. But what I quickly discovered about singing was, it's a different part of you. It's not like me having an actual conversation with you, or me being in a taco restaurant nervously trying to say hi. You're in a totally different context, and it's a band, you know, so it's kind of like a gang. You don't want to be afraid, and pretty soon you're not. We made it through some or maybe all of the songs we'd written, probably starting and stopping each one a few times because we would mess up or forget a part. Eventually, we made it through our set. Phew. What a fucking relief. I don't think we knew what to feel after. Then Dave from Wreckage came up to us and said he had an idea. Why don't you guys make a record and I'll release it? This seemed crazy and unfathomable. Us make a record that you could buy in a store? We had just played our first show in front of other people as Beastie Boys. And now this guy from a great record store wants us to make an actual record for him? What?
A Rubber Band was involved by Michael Diamond, read by John C. Reilly. Did I mention we made a demo sometime before our first show? We made a demo sometime before our first show. Yauch's determination single-handedly made it happen. The idea was that a cassette of songs combined with a photo and maybe a fake flyer for a non-existent show would get us gigs. Somehow Yauch convinced Gregory Crudson and Eric Hofford from the Speedies to bring their Tascam Porta Studio 4-track to the 100th Street Loft. This was 1981, and the Porta Studio, which had only been out a couple of years, was a revolutionary piece of gear. Before that, if you wanted to record anything with four tracks, you'd need a reel-to-reel recorder, which also required a separate mixing desk and a reel of tape from, like, a pro audio store. In other words, you actually needed to know a thing or two. But the Porta Studio would fit in a backpack and record it onto a cassette, which you could get at any corner bodega. It was basically idiot-proof. That shit democratized the recording process in a way that's hard to overstate. They brought over their four-track plus a few mics, and we recorded. Two of the demos got played on Noise the Show, a half-hour weekly NYU radio hardcore show hosted by Tim Sommer. Getting on the radio seemed kind of inconceivable to us, and then it actually fucking happened. WNYU miraculously reached my family's apartment on the Upper West Side. One day I tuned in and heard Tim Sommer screaming about our song Egg Raid on Mojo. Then the song itself came on, and I was so excited that I started solo moshing in my own bedroom, stage diving off my bed. After the song ended, I ran into the hallway where the phone was, dialed Yauch's number, took the phone with its 20-foot-long cord into my room, and catching my breath, tried to explain to Yauch what I had just heard.
Tim Sommer would later go on to become an A&R man at Atlantic Records and sign Hootie and the Blowfish. You can hear his voice sampled on Heart Attack Man on Ill Communication.
Such extremely limited exposure aside, the demo was, in the words of the wise Biz Markie, just a demo. It wasn't great, but it got the job done. It was the first time we'd heard each instrument and the vocals isolated. I remember being freaked out by just how unforgiving it was. When we played live, the volume, crappy club monitors, adrenalized moshing, and general chaos covered everyone's flaws. Recording did the opposite, exaggerated them, shone a light on them. Nowhere to hide. Dave's offer to record us took a while to actually happen. It's not like Walter Yetnikoff from CBS Records was signing us, you know what I mean? It was Dave's first record, too. He had to figure shit out. The Rat Cage store was in the basement of 171 Avenue A. On the first floor was a long, narrow former storefront that had been taken over by these two southern guys, Jerry Williams and Scott Jarvis. They'd relocated their punk band, The Cigarettes, from North Carolina to New York City, at which point the group promptly broke up. So Jerry and Scott turned their apartment into a multi-use musician space. There was a stage at one end, a sound booth with recording equipment up in a loft at the other, and a bunch of dirty, ripped-up couches in between. After that, it became a combo practice space, makeshift recording studio, and after Jerry hooked up with them to produce their fucking incredible self-titled first album, Unofficial HQ of Bad Brains. To us, the fact that Bad Brains had recorded there made the space almost sacred. Jerry had this great southern drawl, but he'd also apparently been picking up some of the Rastafarian patois that Bad Brains would use, so he spoke in some weirdly accented hybrid language of uncertain origin. He had long gray hair, even though he was probably in his mid-30s, long beard with a rubber band involved, super tall and wiry, just generally fit right in among the other downtown eccentrics. Scott was super nice and a little more conventional than Jerry. Faded blue jeans, Converse All-Stars, a haircut that was definitely his own handiwork, and a bit of southern twang as well. I always attributed his humility and friendliness to being southern. Certainly it wasn't the result of living in the East Village. At some point in the fall of 1981, Bad Brains was heading out on tour and Jerry was going with them, so Dave Parsons arranged for us to use the studio to record our EP. Scott had stuck around and would be the engineer and de facto producer, Reed, designated adult. When we finally showed up to record, the process was so new that literally everything was fun. Oh, we need to pound the motherfucking kick drum for 30 minutes straight to make sure it sounds good? Awesome. Bad Brains had taken a bunch of equipment with them on tour, so 171A was about as bare bones as a studio could be. Basically just a four-track reel-to-reel recorder and a mixing desk to operate it. That said, you'd need experience to understand how to route the mixer onto the different tracks, and there were five or six mics that needed to be submixed onto one track. It wasn't until pretty well into recording that it became clear that Scott hadn't done this very often. To his credit, he was honest about it. He basically said, "This is not my studio. I'm just a drummer who kind of knows how everything works. We'll figure this out." And he did. I don't remember him fucking anything up. It took us a day or two to record everything. We set up on the stage at the far end of the room as though we were playing a show. I was out front with a mic, Kate was behind me on the drums, Yauk was playing his first Fender jazz bass, but in order to record things with separation in case we wanted to change or fix anything, it was plugged into a direct input so there was no amplified signal that would bleed into the drums or vocal mics. John Barry was on his Cherrywood Gibson SG, also through a DI. If I remember correctly, we all finished the basic tracks in a day, and most of the overdubs and vocals. The remaining work may have been finished the next day or the next weekend or whatever, but it was fast. Compared to the amount of time we would spend recording albums in the future, it was a fucking nanosecond. I don't remember having any sort of specific ambition with the record. It's not like we were thinking, oh, it should sound like this. Again, we weren't too serious about the hardcore aesthetic. We loved the music and the energy, but our idea was to fuck with all the dogmatic shit that accompanied it. The lyrics I wrote were the most ludicrous and silly things I could come up with, whatever seemed funny to us at the time.
Example. Holy this, holy that, holy fucking big fat rat, holy piss, holy crappers, Jill Kniff, holy snappers.
We had no serious agenda, in contrast to almost every other hardcore band. Which was sort of the idea. To take our small step toward breaking down a predictable formula. The fact that Pollywog Stew captured what we were doing, and it sounded way more professional than we could have imagined, that was good enough for us. Once we finished recording, the plan was to mix everything at 171A sometime over the following few weeks. But in the time between recording and mixing, whoever had the lease on 171A, whether it was Jerry Williams or Scott or Bad Brains or all three, lost it. I don't know if they couldn't pay the rent or didn't want to or whatever. In any case, we got a call from Dave telling us that the studio was out of business. We were like, holy shit, what happens to the stuff we recorded? Like, how does that work? We were worried that Scott had left the tape behind or a landlord repossessed it or something. Once we realized that, yes, he has the tape, but we'll have to mix it at his apartment now, we calmed down a bit. At least until we saw his apartment. New York is obviously known for its small apartments. But even by New York standards, Scott's was tiny. It was one of those East Village specials, a single room of maybe 350 square feet, and to fit anything besides a bed in there, you have to build a loft where you can put your mattress, and usually there's some fucked up feature in the overall design, like the bathtubs in the kitchen or the toilets in the shower. If you didn't live in New York and see that shit all the time, you'd think it was some cartoon exaggeration of a tiny apartment. But it wasn't. We all crammed into this awkward loft bed zone and mixed polywog stew there, the four-track tape machine set up on a small dresser, speakers to the left and right sending signal out through the same small mixing board we used to record. The only effect I remember having was an old Roland space echo, which you can hear deployed on the song Jimmy. Making the artwork, in those days you had to do it with an X-Acto knife and a ruler, and printing it took some time. The record was pressed in England. By the time we finally got everything back and released it, it was the summer of 1982. It felt really good to hold a fucking thing you'd made in your hands. I remember taking a few copies to school, not to show anybody or anything like that, just to have, like, this secret source of confidence and pride in my backpack. The fact that it took almost a year to get done would have seemed like a long time, except we were in school and leading 15-year-old lives, and we'd also occupied ourselves with a new challenge in the meantime, playing live shows somewhere besides John Barry's loft. Transit Cop, inspired by real-life events. Yauk and I were riding the 405 train from Borough Hall into the city one night to go see a show. The train was empty, so Yauk was hanging and swinging from the bars. We were talking and laughing. We stopped at a station, and two transit policemen walked into our train car and right up to us and started yelling at Yauk. "Hey, what do you think you're doing, swinging around like a fucking monkey? If we catch you doing it again, we're giving you a ticket." We were bothering no one. The train was empty, damaging nothing. This was just two dickheads fucking with us because we were punk rock kids with boots and spiked hair. Riot Fight. This and Ode To were probably our most fake political type songs. I mean, we liked Discharge and Crass, but we had no political agenda ourselves. So Riot Fight was really just a tribute song, I guess, and also us kind of laughing at that stuff at the same time, part tribute, part satire. Michelle's Farm. The Michelle in the title refers to our friend Michelle Ford, who was part of our crew of show-going, stamp-faking teenagers, also one of the bag ladies. She lived in Brooklyn and had no farm. Egg Raid on Mojo. The closest this EP comes to a pop single, or maybe even just a song, also based on a true story. Mojo was a large dude who used to go to a lot of the same shows as us. He was also one of the only black kids we'd see at them. At 6'4", wearing bondage pants and a leather jacket and a beret, he stuck out pretty easily. He was nice enough, but it freaked us out a bit that he would totally switch up his look depending on the type of show he was seeing, from punk to hardcore to ska to full-on blitz boy. Mojo was an alternative fashion chameleon. After we'd seen him around a bunch, he got a job working the door at an after-hours club called Berlin, which shared its loft space with another club called Reggae Lounge. The place was kind of awesome. Loud dub and reggae through a legit sound system on one side, new wave on the other. Since we knew Mojo from around, once he started working there, we figured, cool, he'll definitely hook us up and let us in for free. Nope. We go there, and one night, he's out front wearing a flowing white pirate's blouse like fucking Adam Ant or some shit, and he completely pretends not to even know us. No parting of the velvet rope. No, what's up, guys? Come on in. We were like, what the fuck? Anyway, justice served. At some point, we ambushed Mojo outside where he was working the door, pelted him with eggs, and then ran.
We never egg raided him, no matter what anyone says. That never happened. Kate Schellenbach.
Mouth of the Rat by Adam Horovitz. Dave Parsons owned and ran the Rat Cage along with his girlfriend Kathy. Dave was older than all of us kids who hung out at the store. He was a grown-up. He'd lived other lives before any of us met him. He was from Florida. He'd wanted to be a dancer. He once showed me a picture of himself wearing a ballet costume in full ballet pose. Maybe he was in midair, even. It was pretty beautiful. And I remember he kind of tucked the little picture away after he showed it to me, like you do when you know that particular dream will never come true. He was a little older now and living in New York in a new and different life. Dave Parsons was not the typical grown-up who treated you like a kid. He wanted to share ideas and life with us, He seemed to love both the mundane boredom and the frenetic excitement of our teenage lives. He was just as excited as we were when the new Minor Threat record came out. How cool is that for a grown-up? He'd let us put up our flyers for our band's upcoming shows, sell our homemade fanzines and buttons, and basically let us use his place of business as a teen scene. It was like the New York City punk version of a 1950s movie, Malt Shop. Safe to assume that if you were there on a Tuesday at 1 p.m., you were cutting school. But Dave didn't seem to care. Some of us were getting our education at the Rat Cage, important life lessons like financial studies. How are we going to get enough money to get French fries and gravy from the Second Avenue Deli? Technological research consisted of playing video games at Funnenberger down the street. We really did hang out at the Rat Cage all the time. I'd like to say that the bulk of our time there was spent in a creative young folks issues-based think tank, but more factually, our days at the Rat Cage and in the East Village were spent trying to come up with something interesting and dumb to do. You know, like breathe in and out really fast and have someone push on your chest to see if you'd pass out. Anyway, Dave was a dancer, a punk rock record store owner, and also an artist. He drew the lightning bolt illustration for Bad Brain's first record cover. It's been used on a million t-shirts and stickers since then, but I'm pretty sure neither Dave nor Bad Brains ever got any money from any of that. Dave also had a fanzine when he lived in Florida called Mouth of the Rat, so I guess add Ryder to the list. Dave's use of the word rat comes from growing up in Boca Raton. I guess people there call it the rat. I only learned this a year ago on the Google machine. When I think of Dave Parsons, my favorite image is him riding around the East Village on his skateboard. He'd ride to the post office up on 4th Avenue and 11th Street to get a shipment of new records for the store. In the early 80s, you didn't see that many punk rockers, or skaters for that matter, and it made young punk rock me so proud that I knew that funny-looking grown-up punk on the skateboard carrying those heavy boxes. There must have been an easier, more efficient means of product transportation. It's just, he wanted to ride a skateboard. Dave had a connection with a guy in London named John Loder, who had something to do with printing and pressing Crass's records. Crass was a British band and record label that was the fucking zenith of punk. Their music and record covers were political, smart, and weird. To be down with Crass meant you were punk for real. So Dave sent the tapes that were recorded at 171A in Scott Jarvis's apartment to England, and the next thing you know, a real record. Pollywog Stew. I wasn't in Beastie Boys yet. I had a band called The Young and the Useless. My band loved Pollywog Stew so much that we begged and pleaded with Dave to put out a record for us too. And after 10,000 come-ons and pleases, he did. John Loder also had that record press, and I've been lying to people ever since, saying that Crass had a big part of putting our records out. I mean, sort of, right? Dave and Kathy actually lived with me and my mom for a little bit. We had an extra room in our apartment and my mom would rent it out to bring in some money. We had all kinds of people coming through our place. So many that late one night, while Dave and Kathy were staying there, my mom went into the kitchen to get some water and some guy was standing there in the living room area. My mom said to him, "Oh, you must be one of Adam's friends." She got the guy a blanket, a Coke, and a slice of pound cake and told him he could crash on the couch and said goodnight. The next morning, the Coke and cake were gone, as well as Dave's Walkman and $40. Dave and Kathy didn't last long at our place. Things were changing by then. They were breaking up. The Rat Cage was soon closing. And us kids were kind of, sort of, growing up. We were a little older. The Malt Shop wasn't our scene anymore. We wanted to go out to clubs and get involved with grown-up stuff. And so we lost touch with Dave and Kathy. By 1984, our new post-teen, pre-grown-up scene was a club called Danceteria. I hadn't seen or talked to Dave Parsons in a year or so. I arrived at Danceteria one night and was walking around looking for some friends when I hear a familiar voice call my name. I turn around to see a few women posted by the wall. One of the women kind of pops out, and it's Dave, in full drag. Weird dress, bad makeup, pearls. This was a detail I did not know about him. He introduced me to his date, a woman, and we talked for a moment and then said our goodbyes. It was one of those melancholy moments when you see, like, an uncle or grown-up that you love and look up to, but you know that you're not going to see them for a while, maybe never again. And because you're young, you don't know how to tell someone how meaningful they are to you. And then there was the whole, whoa, Dave's cross-dressing now thing that threw me off in the moment. One day, not long after that, Yauk was walking past the rat cage and saw the new wave guy that used to work at the deli on the corner selling all of Dave's stuff. Records, buttons, fanzines, everything. Yauk asked him what was up, and he said that Dave split town. He wouldn't offer up any more information, but it seemed pretty sketchy. Cut 2, 1987. Life has changed. A lot. We're on the License to Ill tour, down in New Orleans. We're at the gig during the day for soundcheck, and our friend Dave Skilkin rushes in, wild, with a crazy story to tell us. He was walking around the French Quarter, doing tourist stuff. Beignets, chicory coffee, some kind of fruit and alcohol drinks. It's a sunny summer day, and there's a bunch of different street performers out with little circles of people gathered around each of them. Out of the corner of his eye, Skilkin thinks he sees Dave Parsons. There's a small crowd around him, and Dave is dressed as Charlie Chaplin. Skilkin kind of ducks around a corner and then peeks out to see if it's really him. As he's looking, Skilkin realizes there's a small crowd of people looking at him because a mime has snuck up behind him and was mimicking all of his shady private eye movements. When Skilkin tells him to go away, the mime would mime, "Go away!" He wouldn't stop, so eventually Skilkin ran away. But someone went back to find Dave and invited him to our show. He ended up coming as Dave Parsons, not Charlie Chaplin. And we talked for a little bit, but didn't really catch up. Some things weren't discussed. Why he left New York City? Why New Orleans? Charlie Chaplin? We all really loved Dave and hoped he was doing okay. We were also total drunk fuck-ups in 1987 and didn't really know how to communicate things like feelings and phone numbers. It wasn't until the late 1990s when Yauk somehow reconnected with Dave. It turned out the whole Charlie Chaplin New Orleans thing was fucking crazy. Back at the tail end of the Rat Cage days, after he split up with Kathy, Dave was broke and needed to break out of New York. He had a friend in New Orleans and was like, fuck it. So he's down there, but he's still broke. His friend had the idea that Dave should go out and do a Charlie Chaplin routine on the street to hustle some money. Dave was like, what do I know from Charlie Chaplin? His friend said, what's the big deal? You get a funny hat, a cane, and a fake mustache, and you're done. You already look and act like fucking Charlie Chaplin. It'll be easy. So he put a makeshift Charlie Chaplin outfit together and hit the streets, and Dave Skilkin just happened to be strolling around the French Quarter of New Orleans and saw Dave Parsons on his very first day as Chaplin. What's even crazier is, that same day, someone from Italy, I think, sees him with the funny mustache and hat twirling a cane and says that they're having some big Charlie Chaplin festival and that he's a great Chaplin impressionist and asks if he would like to go to Europe, all expenses paid, to perform. So of course he did. While at the festival, someone from Charlie Chaplin's estate was so impressed with Dave Parsons' performance and likeness to Charlie Chaplin that they asked him if he'd like to move to Switzerland and live in Charlie Chaplin's family's estate and be the world's go-to Charlie Chaplin impersonator. Now, I could have some of the facts a little off here, but I'm telling you, that's what Dave Parsons told us. There was a picture of him in fucking People magazine. Someone showed it to me, for real. It was like a full-page article on a Charlie Chaplin convention, and there was Dave, right in the middle of the page. By the time Yauk had reconnected with him, Dave Parsons had left his Chaplin days behind him. He was no longer at the Chaplin estate, but was living somewhere else in Switzerland, playing music and now going by the name Daisy, or Daisy, or Donnelly. I believe the name changed a couple times. He was transitioning from male to female. I'm not sure how it all worked specifically, but he really wanted to have gender reassignment surgery. It turns out that being a Charlie Chaplin impersonator doesn't bring in the kind of surplus of cash it takes to pay for such an operation. He needed some money. He also had cancer. Pretty bad. My understanding of Dave's situation was that he was pretty much dying, and that he wanted to live out the rest of the little time he had left in the body of his choosing. I'm using the words he and his because I only knew Dave when he was still going by he. So Yauk took care of it. He organized it so that we gave him the money for the operation, but it was under the guise of reimbursement and unpaid back royalties for the Pollywog Stew record from 1982. Dave, Daisy, got the operation, and then within a year passed away. Without Dave Parsons, Beastie Boys probably would have been a punk band for a couple years and that's it. We never would have taken it seriously. We never would have thought we could do this for a living unless we had made those first couple records for Rat Cage. Dave gave all of us kids somewhere to be, a hangout, a meeting place for music. But most important, he gave us the notion that being a grown